case for argument is Merchant v. Holder, Ms. Baldini-Paterman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Maria Baldini-Poterman, and I represent Petitioner Merchant in this case. This case presents two basic overarching issues. One, an alien's statutory right to apply for relief from removal, and two, to have the applications adjudicated by an immigration judge on their merits. In this particular instance, Mr. Merchant received ineffective assistance of counsel by not one, but two attorneys, and his applications for cancellation of removal, asylum, withholding of removal, and Convention Against Torture Relief have never been decided by a lower court.
Now, in October, his wife was really advised about the terrible representation and that Croto had provided bad advice, but there was no action taken until 2010, so that's the problem I have with it. Isn't it hard to say the board was wrong not to apply equitable tolling?
Your Honor, I do understand the concerns represented on the due diligence factor here and the equitable tolling. If this court finds that Mr. Merchant did not exercise due diligence through his wife as he was detained in custody of the service and unable to himself go door to door to find a competent attorney and to retain counsel on his own, then we ask that this court look at the issue of the board's abuse of discretion in denying his motion for cancellation removal on the grounds of sua sponte. Following the Supreme Court's Cucana decision, the Supreme Court in its Cucana decision specifically left open at footnote 18 the issue of whether the federal courts have jurisdiction to review denials of sua sponte motions to reopen by the board. The Sixth Circuit recently called into question its own precedent and gave a call that the Sixth Circuit's entire court review the issue.
But how could, I don't understand, what would be the standard that a court would be applying in reviewing a sua sponte motion to reopen? The board wouldn't have to give reasons, right?
Your Honor, the board has, in its case law, outlined that it can exercise its sua sponte jurisdiction in extraordinary circumstances. And
it doesn't have to write an opinion every time it refuses to reopen a case on its own motion. I mean, that would be ridiculous. I mean, what would that mean?
Write
an opinion every day saying we haven't decided to reopen any cases today, or what?
In the factors that are presented in this particular case, Your Honor, with regard to the sua sponte jurisdiction, I believe this court should find it troubling, as the board did, that two attorneys below rendered not only ineffective assistance of counsel, but also some potential fraud upon both tribunals below.
But what I understand, maybe you have to explain what this sua sponte motion to reopen is. I don't understand it. Are there standards as to when you can ask the board to reopen a case sua sponte?
Your Honor?
Sua sponte usually means the court is doing something without having been asked by anybody.
There is a regulation that was created by the Attorney General giving the Board of Immigration Appeals power to, on its own motion, to reopen. Because
Is there a standard set forth for that?
Your Honor, the only standard that's set forth by the board with respect to sua sponte motions has been that they will reopen or grant a motion to reopen sua sponte in extraordinary circumstances.
That's not a standard.
Your Honor,
Under the APA, if there's no law to be applied to an administrative decision, there's no judicial review. Why isn't that the situation? What standard would a court apply? Say, well, we think this is extraordinary, unextraordinary, ordinary, but it's completely formless.
Your Honor, as far as what standard is to be applied, in the context of a motion to reopen, this Court applies an abuse of discretion standard to see whether the Board abused its discretion.
That's just the scope of review. The question is, what is the standard in which you say to the Board, well, you know, you said you didn't reopen this, means you didn't think it was extraordinary. Well, where do you go from there? Court says is, there are grounds for reopening, like, you know, of course, the changed country conditions, and you have a right to reopen within specified time. But if you just appear 20 years later and say, well, we'd like you to reopen it, and the Board says no, what is a court supposed to do?
Your Honor, I believe that the Court can review it to determine whether or not extraordinary circumstances were presented. And in the totality...
Extraordinary circumstances. I mean, suppose a person, you know, has been here, came on a student visa or something 30 years ago, and then he applied for adjustment of status. Now, he applied many times, was always denied, and he applied for... this and he applied for that and he moved to reopen within the deadline after he's ordered removed and he was denied and he didn't leave and he's still here. And now he says, now he files more motions to reopen. Every day he files a motion to reopen. And does the Board have to write an opinion saying why it's not an extraordinary case? They'll just be inundated. They are inundated anyway. Now they'll be, let's see, file every day, say, all right, what does the Board do?
Your Honor, I'd like
write
to...
Write an opinion every day?
I'd like to address an answer.
Write an opinion every time someone asks it to reopen sua sponte?
Your Honor, under the
yes or
APA...
No. I ask you a yes or no question. Does it have to write an opinion every time it denies, every time it refuses to exercise its sua sponte power?
Yes.
Well, that's ridiculous, right? You'll have a million of these.
Your Honor, the standard...
Finally, the Board will be utterly incapable of writing opinions, and so then the immigrant will come to the court and say, look, they didn't write an opinion, so...
As this court and other courts have...
Why they didn't think my 45th motion for them to reopen wasn't extraordinary.
Your Honor, as we've outlined in our brief, I do believe the Board should at some point enunciate a standard of what it means by exceptional circumstances. Other courts have remanded cases to the Board to issue published opinions on what is defined as an exceptional circumstance for purposes of whatever provision of law. In this particular case, you have an alien who never had his day in court, regarding two very viable forms of relief at the time he was represented by Attorney Croutot.
Williams pointed out, you know, unjustified delay is a conventional standard, conventional ground for denying extraordinary relief. Why isn't that good enough?
In this particular case, he not only raised the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, he also raised an issue regarding a motion reopen based on materially changed country conditions, which is a statutory exception to the filing deadline.
Of course, that's completely separate. That's completely separate, the changed conditions. That doesn't have this sua sponte problem. That's fine. That's not, you don't have a, I don't think you have a procedural obstacle there. Question whether the circumstances have changed enough, you know, in relation to your client to require relief. That's straightforward, I think. It's this business of having appellate review of all these refusals to issue to reopen sua sponte that troubles me.
And your enunciation of the difficulty of when does a deportation case ever end is understandable. In this particular instance, again, however, you have not one but two attorneys who rendered ineffective assistance of counsel. And in particular...
That doesn't wipe out the question of timeliness.
We agree, Your Honor, that it doesn't wipe out the issue of timeliness. With respect, again, to when the motion to reopen was filed by Attorney Sanders, in looking at the circumstances from October 11th of 08, when he was detained by a local state trooper, to when it was filed in March, during that time period, he was in custody, and he relied on his family member, being his wife, to obtain new counsel to file the motion.
Custody doesn't prevent you from filing. On the contrary, it gives you a stronger incentive to do so.
Your Honor, with respect to the issue of sua sponte jurisdiction, our argument is that we believe there are exceptional circumstances that were presented in this case, and in particular the conduct of the attorneys below. And Mr.
Murtaugh, let me ask you about the changed country conditions. So the problem is that you have a situation where there's an entire group in a country that are, they're discriminated against and there's sporadic violence against them, and the government is not very protective of them, partly because the government is has very little control, and partly because the government is not sympathetic because it's dominated by the other group, of course. But if that's enough for asylum, doesn't it imply that, like, literally millions of people in Pakistan are eligible for asylum? What is it that, what's special about, see, in most of our cases, the defendant is not only, I mean, the petitioner is not only a member of a group that's disliked in his country, but he actually has been, you know, fingered in some way. He's been arrested, or, you know, police know who he is. They're looking for something of that sort. Rather than just being a member of a group which puts you at a higher risk, but you haven't been identified as an enemy of the state.
Your Honor, in this particular instance, he is a member of a minority sect of the Shia religion. The Shia,
yes, I just said that, right? He's a member of a group that's disliked, discriminated against. There isn't an official government policy of persecuting these people, but the government may be complicit, may close its eyes to it, or may just be incompetent. So what distinguishes him from all the other members of religious minorities or heretical Islam, you know, in Pakistan?
My time has expired. May I have an additional minute?
Well, why would I ask you a question and not want you to answer it, right? Would that have any point?
Your Honor, he is married to a member of the majority religion, to a Sunni, and that places him in a different situation than someone who is merely Shia. Because they have an interfaith marriage, he is going to be targeted. His wife is in the United States presently. However, she does not have status, as we indicated in our brief. So if he were to be removed, she would go with him, along with the two U.S. citizen children who do not speak the Urdu language. The children will stand out as children of an interfaith marriage. As we discussed in our brief, because the children are of an interfaith marriage, they are going to be subject to persecution, as will he. He would also be returning.
Now, this is what is presented in your motion. What you're saying now is in your motion?
It's in the brief, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
It's in our opening brief as well as in the motion.
No, but I'm interested in what you presented to the board, not to us.
Yes, Your Honor. We fully briefed that to the board, and we...
Did they discuss any of it, or what did they do with it? Refresh my recollection what they did.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the part on the asylum, withholding, and CAT claims, at Appendix 4 to 5, they discussed the issue of his eligibility for asylum. And the board acknowledged the country condition material, but they said that he didn't demonstrate that he would be at greater risk of being harmed than the rest of the population there. And that.
So the key thing is where they say he has not shown that there has been a material change in Pakistan. Is that the critical statement?
Yes, Your Honor. And I have administrative record sites where the State Department itself has evidence that there have been attacks specifically against Shia, and that was in the material that we presented to the board with our reply brief to DHS's opposition. Specifically, the 2009 country report issued in March of 2010, Admin Record Citation 52, direct quote, "Police often fail to protect members of religious minorities from societal attacks, including Christians, Amidists, and Shias." Another direct quote, page 57 of the administrative record, "Sectarian killings related to conflict were also widespread." It further goes on to discuss a specific attack against four Shia school children who were shot dead and killed. The Freedom House at Administrative Record Citation 829 also talks about the targeting specifically of foreigners, Shiite Muslims, and Christians, killing at least several hundred civilians each year. The 2009 Religious Freedom Report on Pakistan from September of 2009 by the Department of State also discusses that violence against religious minorities and Muslim sects continued. Most believed a small minority was responsible for attacks. However, discriminatory laws and the teaching of religious intolerance created a permissive environment for such attacks. Police often refused to prevent violence and harassment or refused to charge persons who committed such offenses. Administrative Record Citation 760.
Okay.
As far as the...
Your time has expired. There's no pending questions, so you have to sit down. Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Baldini, Chairman. Ms. Curlin?
May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Carlin, and I represent the United States Attorney General, who's the respondent in this case. With regards to petitioner's argument about Kukana, Kukana is in opposite to this case because it dealt with the narrow jurisdictional limitation of 1252A2B2, and this is separate and distinct from the jurisdictional limitation that is implicated by sua sponte reopening, which, as Kukana and this court in Pilch recognize, is derived from Heckler v. Cheney. Thus, there is no 1252A2D review of a denial of sua sponte reopening because Heckler is not a jurisdictional limitation under the INA. And the court in Kukana expressly recognized that and declined to consider sua sponte reopening because it recognized that courts have long held that such decisions are unreviewable because sua sponte reopening is committed to agency discretion by law and citing to 701A2 of the APA, which was the provision at issue in Heckler.
Sua sponte reopenings are based on what? Notification by an interested party, a petitioner, would indicate, I've got a problem, please use your discretion.
Well, in most cases, individuals would, in filing the motion, would ask for the court to exercise that authority, and that is a separate and distinct decision that the board makes, because its authority for sua sponte reopening is derived on its decision to not reopen something. Sua sponte is its decision to decline to reopen on its own motion. So because it's a decision of the board saying we will not exercise our authority to reopen, not based on any statute, just because we feel that this is not an extraordinary circumstance, that's it.
But it's asked, I think what Judge Kent and I'm curious about, but it was it's asked. It's always asked to, right?
Yes.
I mean, it never
usually
just
is asked.
You know,
they don't just think about it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
it's usually asked, but the board mm-hmm. can also, in certain situations, just say.
Well, sua sponte means that.
Right.
Without
mm-hmm.
being asked that, yes, right. We will reopen.
Now here we had a petitioner with ineffective lawyers, really twice, not informed of the deadline. Why shouldn't the time filing considerations be more lenient in a situation like this? Because we don't have a situation, you know, where he was arrested and all those other things that Judge Posner outlined. I mean, why shouldn't there be some leniency?
Because the board considered that situation and considered the petitioner's ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And the problem is that petitioner has to demonstrate, before even reaching the issue of prejudice, he has to demonstrate that he exercised due diligence with regard to filing the claim against his former counsel. Because this, again, we are looking at an untimely motion to reopen, not a timely motion to reopen. So when the board looked at Attorney Croteau's, what happened with Attorney Croteau, the board saw that based on petitioner's own admission, he and his wife discovered that that attorney was ineffective in October of 2008. She, at that time, she even went so forward and decided to retain that attorney, but then changed her mind later on because she wanted to find another attorney that she felt more comfortable with. And it wasn't until she retained Attorney Sanders in July of 2009 to file, and it wasn't until then that she filed an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. That's a year and a half after finding out that he was ineffective. And that's after her husband had been jailed and was in immigration custody. Now, the fact that, and then with regards to Attorney Sanders, turning the question of Attorney Sanders, there's no, the board, of course, accepted that petitioner exercised due diligence in filing that claim. The problem is that petitioner's claim of prejudice is based on a fraudulent past persecution claim that his wife affirmatively presented, arguably, to Attorney Sanders. So the and aside from that, the board's decision in denying that the motion to reopen filed by Attorney Sanders was not based on that past persecution claim. The board based its decision on the fact that petitioner had not established material change circumstances in Pakistan to excuse the untimely motion.
How long has she been in the United States?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How long has his wife been in the United States?
I'm not sure of that fact. I cannot recall.
You know,
that
people from there are many foreign countries in which you can only get anything from government by bribery or fraud or something else. And sometimes people who come here assume our system is the same, and you know, fraudulent document. That's just the way business is done, right? In many countries.
Well,
so is it clear that she really knew what was going on when this lawyer seemed to have suggested doing this?
It's pretty clear that she knew because she obtained the documents from petitioner's nephew, knowing that they were false, and submitted it to the Dr. Rana, who she alleges is in partnership with Attorney Sanders. Now, whether or not that's what the board acknowledged when it said that this claim is troubling, because if an individual submits a fraudulent claim saying, here you go, you may want to file this or you may not, but it's up to you. No, there must be some, they're implicitly in asserting that and presenting the attorney with those documents, there's a possibility that it may be used. And
he's talking about cultural orientation. That's what he was trying to focus on. I just have one quick question, and I realize this is speculative, but what would the government's position have been if Merchant had applied for cancellation of removal at the outset?
I don't know.
But things certainly would have looked good for them.
I cannot make that determination because at the time that if he had applied for cancellation at the outset, he had one U.S. citizen child who was at the age of 3, and I don't know what
okay.
the board would have decided.
I mean, I know I was asking
in its discretion.
That.
I'm sorry.
Let me ask you a question about these changed country conditions. The board's discussion is very terse, and one of the documents that it cites as showing that conditions have not changed is a 2005 document. It's a 2010 opinion, and of course the situation for Shiites in Pakistan has been deteriorating rapidly with the rise of the Taliban in Pakistan. So shouldn't the board be discussing that?
Well,
the board seems oblivious to the fact that conditions have deteriorated in Pakistan in the last couple of years very, very seriously.
Well, I don't think the board is oblivious to it. The board.
Well, if it doesn't say anything, it's hard for us to know whether it's oblivious or not.
Well, the board was looking at it in terms of whether it was a material change that was sufficient to indicate that petitioner would be subject to persecution.
The newspapers would say there has been a material change because of the Taliban used not to. They used Pakistan as a base, but they didn't attack people in Pakistan. That's changed. I mean, just a few weeks ago, or maybe a week ago, bomb a bus and blow up a bunch of people, and there's a lot of that going on. They might have said, we realize the situation has deteriorated, but not enough to put these people in substantial danger. They could say that, but it looks like sort of boilerplate what they say, no material change.
Well, Your Honor, keeping in mind this is actually the second decision that the board has issued, much of the evidence, including that 2005 report, is similar to evidence that was presented before the board in Attorney Sanders' untimely motion to reopen. And the board, in its decision in that, with regards to its denial of that case, also acknowledged that this evidence predates and was in existence at the time of the 2006 hearing. And the thing about what the documents show is that
the situation has deteriorated in the last 2 years.
But the deterioration is, according to the documents, that Pakistan is an Islamic state, and it has been dealing with issues of interreligious conflict and sectarian violence since at least the 1950s. The documents also show that the government has been attempting and trying to deal with that violence because it knows that it's caused mostly by the Taliban and extremist groups that are trying to destabilize the country.
The Pakistan government has a very complex relationship with the Taliban, right? It supports the Taliban in Afghanistan. It would like the Taliban to leave it alone in Pakistan. But it has this very complicated relation. There's great hostility in Pakistan to not only to non-Muslims, but to heretical Muslims and Shiites, for example, but also some of the Sunnis. So you'd think the board, I would be more comfortable if the board would evince some recognition, with some evidence that they're actually aware of contemporary developments in these countries, rather than just what happened in 1948, right?
Well, the board actually included with the documents was the 2009 Department of State report, and the board acknowledged that it reviewed that. I don't believe that the board's decision, just because it says that there's no...
These country reports, they're prepared by the State Department. The United States has an extremely complex relationship with Pakistan. It is very reluctant to denounce Pakistan, which is more or less an ally of the United States. We have all sorts of troops there and all sorts of stuff going on. And don't you think the State Department is likely to pull its punches when it talks about abusive practices in Pakistan?
Well, we tend to believe and trust that the State Department reports are objective evidence.
You believe that? On what basis?
Because the State Department report is supposed to be...
Because it's produced by the State Department, it must be objective. As if the State Department were a university think tank.
Well, I tend to believe that the State Department reports, the State Department makes an effort to present both sides of the story and to present what it can objectively prove and show of reports of certain violence. And again, we have to look at what the board had before it as what petitioner, because it was petitioner's burden of proof in showing that there was material change circumstances. And because it was petitioner's burden of proof, the board is circumscribed by what is in the record and what petitioner has presented. And the documents that petitioner has presented in this case, the board acknowledged, did not show that. And some of those documents were similar to the documents that had been provided in his second untimely motion.
Circumscribed by what the petitioner presents?
Because it's the petitioner's burden of
proof. Yeah, but it can certainly look at other things.
But it has to base its decision on the record. And that would, so that it could allow a court to review that. So in closing, Your Honor, I'd like to just say that...
the board can look up one of these country reports by the State Department and base its decision on it, even if it's not presented by the petitioner.
Yes, Your Honor, but that is acknowledged as State Department reports are accepted as...
I know, but you said circumscribed by the record. But no, they go out and make a new record with more documents in it, right? Like the State Department report.
But if they do consider that, that's always included in the record.
Okay.
So in closing, Your Honor, I'd like to just again say that the court should... find that the board did not abuse its discretion and exercise its broad discretion in declining to equitably toll petitioner's untimely motion to reopen with regard to the ineffective assistance of counsel claims, and then that the board also exercised its broad discretion in finding that petitioner had not established changed circumstances in Pakistan to excuse the untimely filing.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Crown. So, Ms. Baldini-Paterno, your time expired, but we'll give you a minute if you have anything of note.
Thank you, Your Honors. I wanted to make just 3 points to rebut some of the points brought up by the government. Footnote 18, the Supreme Court in Kukana expressly said, we express no opinion on whether federal courts may review the board's decision not to reopen removal proceedings sua sponte.
We know that. So Ms. Kulan says you really didn't present to the board anything new about Pakistan. Just
Your
old
Honor,
hat stuff going back to 1948, so...
We did submit substantial documentation of the conditions that occurred in 2009 and 2010 to the board in our motion to reopen that showed that the violence has dramatically spiked against Shia Muslims, and the government is also unable to control the Taliban's attacks against the Shia Muslims. It's contained in the administrative record.
Let me ask you this. What about the intermarriage? I mean, you know, the children. And the fact, you know, was there any specific evidence on that?
Of U.S. citizen children being attacked
yes,
in Pakistan?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We presented evidence regarding Shia children who were attacked on school grounds by the Taliban. There are articles, one including an article by, I believe it was the Christian Science Monitor from 2010, so that Shia children and the children would be perceived as being Shia children in Pakistan because the Sunni Muslims will not recognize the marriage between a Sunni woman and a Shia man. So we did present that argument to the board, and it's also in the affidavits that were presented. Their own family members rejected this marriage initially because it's an interreligious marriage. One other point that I wanted to correct about a factual point that the government presented. Counsel stated that he did not apply for cancellation. He did actually file an application with the immigration judge. On the day of the final hearing, Attorney Croteau withdrew that application for cancellation. So there was an application filed. However, Attorney Croteau never submitted one piece of documentation in support of the application. And finally, this court has expressed its concern about collusion between attorneys. Attorney Croteau and Attorney Sanders were housed in the same law firm at one point. Even when, in particular, I'm referring back to the Stroy decision by this court. As we laid out in the motion to reopen, they were part of the same firm. Attorney Croteau then left the firm, went out on his own. With respect to what Attorney Sanders did, he advised him to file a claim with the ARDC. However, Attorney Sanders never filed an actual motion to reopen under Lozada with the BIA. Instead, Attorney Sanders only filed a motion to reopen with the asylum application. So Attorney Sanders, in essence, committed additional ineffective assistance of counsel by failing to advise Mr. Merchant to go through with the ineffective assistance claim when he filed the motion not in July of 2009, as counsel indicated, but in March of 2009. So previously. So I wanted to just clarify those facts for this court.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to both counsel for a very good argument. And the court will be in recess.